Welcome to the deep dive. You've handed us your sources, and well, our job is to cut through all that noise, pull out the really essential stuff, and basically give you the shortcut to getting up to speed. So today, we're diving into something pretty fascinating, how food actually interacts with your body. We're zooming in on the glycemic index, or GI. Yeah, our mission here is pretty straightforward. We're going to unpack the core ideas from this stack of info you gave us, figure out what the GI actually is, what kinds of things change it, and honestly, why knowing about it might be more relevant to you than you perhaps think. Let's get into these sources. Okay, so let's start at square one, right? The foundation. The sources define the glycemic index as, well, it's a measure of how much and how quickly a food with carbs makes your blood sugar go up after you eat it.
Exactly. Think of it like a speed and height gauge for that sugar response in your body.
And there's a standard scale they use.
Yeah, and runs from 0 to 100. And 100, that's pure glucose, like grape sugar. Yep. It's sort of the ultimate benchmark for how fast sugar can possibly hit your bloodstream. Everything else gets compared to that.
Okay, and that scale then breaks down into categories, doesn't it? So what does it mean if a food is, say, low on that scale?
Right, so low GI foods score below 55. And the important thing here, based on the sources, is what that means for your body. You get this slower, steadier rise in blood sugar.
Which means?
Which means more sustained energy. It helps you feel full for longer. And that steady level, you know, it can really help manage those afternoon slumps or cravings.
Makes sense. So low is under 55. What's the middle and the high end?
Between 55 and 70, that's generally considered medium GI. And then anything over 70 is high GI.
And with high GI foods, what happens then?
Well, the sources point out that your blood sugar spikes up really fast, but often it drops just as quickly afterwards.
The classic sugar crash.
Exactly that. That rapid fall is often why you might feel tired or hungry again pretty soon after eating something high GI.
It's interesting, though. The sources also suggest kind of a practical target aiming for foods with a GI under 65 as a sort of general guideline. That's not super strict low GI, but it's definitely being mindful.
Yeah, that 65 number is helpful because it acknowledges you don't have to, like, eliminate everything that isn't technically low GI. It's more about making informed choices, you know, most of the time.
And looking at the foods mentioned in the sources, it seems pretty achievable. Lots of fruits, apples, pears, berries, oranges, they fit comfortably under 65.
Totally. And even potatoes, which often get labeled as just high GI, they can work. It just depends on, well, how you prepare them.
Okay, now this is where it gets really interesting based on what we read. The GI for a food isn't fixed.
Not at all. That's one of the most fascinating takeaways from these sources. It's surprisingly dynamic.
Dynamic how? Give me that potato example again.
Okay, so take a potato. Freshly cooked, served hot. It generally has a fairly high GI. But if you cook that same potato and then let it cool right down, like for potato salad.
Yeah, what happens?
Something chemical actually happens inside. When it cools, some of the starches change form. They become what's called resistant starch.
Resistant starch, okay. Sounds like it does what it says.
Pretty much. It resists digestion in your small intestine. So it acts a bit more like fiber, slowing down how quickly the sugar gets released into your blood.
Wow. So a cold potato could actually have a lower GI than the same potato served hot.
Significantly lower, potentially, yeah. Just the temperature changes its impact.
That's wild. And processing too, right? The sources really emphasize that.
Oh, absolutely. Think about mashed potatoes, like a smooth puree versus maybe just a boiled or baked potato. That puree, it's been heavily processed.
Broken down more.
Exactly. The structure is broken down, making the starch super available for quick absorption. The sources show this really bumps up the GI compared to the less processed whole or sliced potato.
So more processing, faster sugar hit. Got it.
Mm-hmm.
What about eating the carb with other stuff? Does that change the GI?
Huge difference. The sources are very clear on this. If you eat that potato, but maybe with some olive oil, so some fat, or with protein like chicken or an egg,
okay,
the overall digestion of that whole meal slows right down.
And the effect on blood sugar?
Well, the sugar from the potato still gets absorbed, obviously, but it happens over a much longer time. It smooths out that spike you'd get from the potato on its own. The blood sugar curve becomes, you know, much gentler.
Okay, this is starting to click. We've got the GI for a food alone, but how you cook it, cool it, or combine it can totally change the picture. But then the sources bring in another concept, glycemic load, or GL. Why do we need that too?
That's a really good question. The limitation of the GI, as the sources explain it, is that it's usually based on a fixed amount of carbs, like 50 grams. But let's be honest, who eats exactly 50 grams of carbs from everything?
Right. You wouldn't eat the same weight of watermelon as you would, say, bread to get 50 grams of carbs. The portion sizes are completely different.
Exactly. And that's where the glycemic load, the GL, comes in. It's more insightful for the real world. It takes that GI number, but then adjusts it based on how much carbohydrate is in a typical serving of that food.
Ah, so it connects the speed factor, GI, with the actual amount of carbs you're likely eating.
Precisely. It gives you a much better estimate of the food's actual total impact on your blood sugar, considering both the quality or speed and the quantity.
And the classic example the sources use for this is watermelon, right? That illustrates it perfectly.
It really does. Watermelon actually has a pretty high GI. The sugars in it are absorbed quickly. But a normal slice of watermelon is mostly water. It doesn't actually contain that many carbohydrates per serving. So you multiply its high GI by its low carb amount.
And the overall glycemic load ends up being low.
Exactly. So even though the sugar type is fast acting, there just isn't much of it in a normal portion. The total impact on your blood sugar isn't huge. That's why GL adds such important context.
Okay, right. So we've unpacked GI, how cooking and combining foods messes with it, and how GL gives us that more practical, portion-aware view. So the big question from these sources, what does this actually mean for you, the listener? Why should someone care about GI and GL?
Well, the sources stress this isn't just theory. Understanding this stuff can be really useful. It's especially relevant if you're, say, trying to manage your weight, or if you have diabetes, or even if you just notice those energy peaks and crashes during the day.
Right. It gives you a way to make choices that might directly affect how you feel energy-wise. And the sources mention benefits for active people, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. For athletes, or even just people who are regularly active, lower GL foods provide that steadier, slow-release energy. Good for endurance.
Okay.
And they can help your body tap into fat for fuel during longer exercise sessions and might even support better recovery afterwards.
So if we boil down the main message from this information you gave us, the glycemic index and load, they're not meant to be like a super strict diet plan or a set of rules you must follow perfectly?
No, not at all. The sources frame it much more as a practical tool. It's about building awareness, maybe being a bit more conscious about the types of carbs you choose, and importantly, how you eat them, the combinations.
And the potential benefit, according to these sources, it could help you feel fitter, have more stable energy, maybe even help manage mood swings tied to blood sugar, and generally support healthier eating long term.
And crucially, the sources emphasize this knowledge lets you make more informed choices without having to demonize foods or sacrifice enjoyment. It moves away from simple good food, bad food labels towards understanding impact.
Okay, so we've taken your sources, we've pulled out the core ideas, what GI is, the factors like prep and combinations that change it, how GL adds that real-world layer, and why this knowledge can actually be pretty useful for energy, health, maybe fitness goals.
Yeah, hopefully this deep dive has given you some really practical insights into how the food choices you make influence your body's energy and blood sugar.
And maybe, based on everything we've just talked about, especially how preparation and combinations can fundamentally alter a food's effect, it raises a question for you to think about. Does understanding this change how you view foods you might have previously just labeled as good or bad? Does it make you see them a bit differently, perhaps more like tools with different effects depending on how you use them?